found that it helps hypo your interest to have a small bet on one of the teams, or to know somebody's brother or cousin you can root for. One football season, I adopted John Arnett of the USC Trojans. I pretended I was his mother and felt how she would feel watching the game. Actually, she probably had cold compresses on her head with somebody staked out at the TV set to tell her when it was over. Then, because of some NCAA ruling, John was benched for a semester and I lost heart. Now, on Rose Bowl day and during the World Series, I simply chloroform myself. As for good posture and expensive jewelry, she herself had multiple plastic surgeries and underwent breast augmentation at the late age of 73. Of course, evolving and proliferating social and domestic roles for women have been discussed from the moment discussion was born, and it is sometimes interesting to look back and see which individual women move into that evolution with a professional eye to claim a historical moment for themselves, or just to make one up. There are always currents to ride, and they are ridden. Hence, a look back at the social swirl of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s with the new biographies of Not Pretty Enough, The Unlikely Triumph of Helen Gurley Brown by Jerry Hershey, and the more innuendo-laden Enter Helen, The Invention of Helen Gurley Brown and the Rise of the Modern Single Woman by Brooke Hauser. Both Hershey and Hauser believed that Brown was something of a pioneer, and that her life and writings laid the groundwork for later commercial white person fictions such as Sex and the City and Mad Men, which, somewhat, extolled the virtues of work for women as if it were a new and glamorous idea. Both biographers spent a lot of time at the Helen Gurley Brown archives at Smith College and have generous things to say about the librarians there. What does modern single woman even mean anymore? It is a phrase that has been with us for quite a while and may be an improvement on spinster, although spinster is being hiply refurbished and celebrated as a lifestyle and not a temporary or pseudo-crippling condition. Single and modern have ephemeral youth built into them, so the word spinster has been reclaimed as a preference for women of any age, dismayed at having to depend on men for very much. See Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own by Kate Bollock. Helen Gurley Brown, we glean, perhaps more from her own writing than from the biographies of Hershey and Hauser, was obsessed with the ostensibly fun culture of American offices and corporate expense accounts in a post-war boom economy. She began her own office career in the 1940s when she was still in her teens. She eventually became a successful copywriter for a Los Angeles ad agency, her first major client being Catalina Swimsuits. She worked even on weekends and stayed late when the men went home to their families. She then moved on to another agency which doubled her salary, and there she began naming lipsticks and writing copy for Max Factor. According to Hershey, she became the highest-paid woman in West Coast advertising. At 37, she owned a Mercedes and a stock portfolio and had never been married. Although she didn't believe in worrying about that, she had begun to worry. Marry late, she nonetheless advised. You can have babies until you're 40 or older, and if you happen to die before they are 40, you will avoid those tiresome years as an unpaid babysitter. Frankly, the magazines and their marriage statistics give me a royal pain. When baby boomers such as Leslie Stahl are currently peddling books on their own besmitten grandmotherhood, see Stahl's Becoming Grandma, Brown's 50-year-old advice can still seem refreshing and iconoclastic. Well, Brown took on many sacred cows that had already been half-throttled, or at least smacked about in various marginalized countercultures. Somewhat amoral regarding sex, although she felt a woman should never bargain sexually for a dinette set, she lived a lot of her life as a quasi-courtesan, which led to pleasure, love, heartbreak, adultery, nutritionists, psychotherapy with the author of Sex Can Be Art. In group therapy, when she was called a slut, she had to go home and look up the word. and eventually marriage to the film producer David Brown, a bright, successful, devoted man. There was some subsequent adultery thrown in here and there for excitement, though the marriage was strong, allowing each to dance with others, Brown's quite literal preference at social gatherings. She and her husband worked together. They buoyed and anchored each other. They plotted together. They ate diet jello together. Though the courtship had its bumps, once they were married, they were thought of as inseparable. When early in their marriage her husband happened upon some amusing, nay, sparkling letters his wife had written to friends, he encouraged her to write a book. Mr. Brown liked writers and had something of a crush on the novelist Rona Jaffe. Mrs. Brown wrote as she spoke, advice she continued to give writers. And since they both knew that sex sold and Mr. Brown felt that Mrs. Brown had some interesting things to say about the bachelorette life, in Hershey's phrase, some lubricious operating instructions for being single, Helen Brown sat down with her high-speed typing and began several different sorts of drafts. What she ended up with was in large part a spirited rebuttal to a widely discussed 1960 Look magazine article, Women Without Men, which had offended her with its depiction of a parched and barren single life. Hershey astutely notes the social class anger in Brown's book, but also acknowledges that Brown was interested not in a revolution, but in a practical navigation of an unfair system that was not going to change in time for you. Her message was beamed to working single women with limited options and means, who were still thrashing in the steno pool, who slept fitfully in a crown of bobby pins when the salon was too dear. One person's shocking truth confided vividly and recognizably can make others feel better. That is perhaps the very heart of the modern and certainly is at the core of Brown's sense of sisterhood. It also came from every part of Brown's life. The Arkansas girlfriends, the California psychotherapy, the reading of novels, all of which consoled her. With disapproval from her family and blurbs from Joan Crawford and Gypsy Rose Lee, Helen Gurley Brown soon became the best-selling author of Sex and the Single Girl. The book contained no-nonsense advice, a wised-up older sister tone, some recipes, some beauty tips, some body anecdotes, stock tips, racetrack tips, bet the favorites to show, a defense of anorexia, a word never used, the extremely thin Helen Brown simply believed in not eating, and decorating suggestions for the bachelorette pad. Imitations ensued, including Sex and the Single Man, over which Brown sued for title infringement. One book that followed Brown's and imitated her Get the Heck Out of Your Childhood philosophy was Jean Bayer's The Single Girl Goes to Town, 1968, which more or less advises the single girl to choose Los Angeles or New York only, not to bother with other cities, saying that in Malibu, every night there is a party somewhere, and if you're not invited, just walk in. Nobody cares. Lest you think this is simply the freewheeling 1960s, Bayer's book also contains an earnings chart to calculate the financial worth of your targeted man, plus gift suggestions for various hostesses whose parties you may be crashing. Both Bayer and Brown failed to warn against being arrested as a stalker, or a burglar, or being murdered by someone you don't know, as you eat your picnic alone in a park. Brown's suggestion is a man's snare. But instead, both do warn against the misleading, if endearing, charms of homosexuals. Now that gaydar has been invented, this seems a bit antique. David Rubin's Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Sex, 1969, didn't come out until 7 years after Brown's book. But clearly, there was consumer demand for all. Gurley, steeped in Alfred Kinsey's 1953 report on female sexuality, was ahead of other authors of how-tos in pronouncing openly on what so many already privately knew. But that it was a woman saying all this, be free. Enjoy sex, have more than one partner, stay financially independent, seemed like news, though it was not news to Brown or her Arkansas gal pals, who had always lived this way. Her book was a sensation and was even sold to the movies. Or rather, its title was sold to Warner Brothers at $40,000 a word, as Life magazine put it, which resulted in a script co-written by Joseph Heller and an otherwise unremarkable film but for its surreal and interminable car chase. Heller's idea of the madcap single life? Its all-star cast, and a scene in which Natalie Wood, playing a fictional psychotherapist named Helen Brown, eerily falls into the ocean at night and almost drowns. Helen Gurley grew up in Little Rock as what she called a hillbilly, though as Hauser rightly points out, she was sturdily middle class. Her mother was a teacher, her father a state legislator. But then she had a taste of poverty and tragedy when her father was killed in a freak elevator accident in the state capitol building, and the insurance money subsequently ran out. Her sister was disabled by polio. Their mother eventually moved them first to Tulsa and then to Los Angeles, where Brown remained and went to secretarial school. Over the decade, she held 19 different office jobs there. It was a particular moment in social and economic history. A young woman could move around at that time and not cling to a partner or any one job, because female office employees were in demand. For one thing, they were underpaid, and rent was affordable. Brown had a lively prose style, compulsively wrote thank you notes with her favorite term of endearment, pussycat, and believed in women not so much as sex objects, but as sex subjects. Men were the actual objects. She had a confessional bent. Like Joan Rivers and Nora Ephron, she was not a creative genius, but a disciplined workaholic, with a springy cadence in her sentences. She too felt bad about her neck. She too wanted to make a lot of money. She too was an amusing woman attached to something larger in the culture and wished to report on it. The sexual revolution was not feminism, though there was a blurry overlap, and both movements had their waters muddied, then clarified, then expanded, by gay rights and gender liberation. Is it politically permissible to wear false eyelashes and high heels and protest the meaninglessness of life without romantic love, wondering out loud where you went wrong? Well, you can if you're Prince, but only if you're Prince. The disruption and dismantling of patriarchal sexual culture can occur in a lot of different ways, and it has taken various kinds of people to do it. Social change involves a more or less generalized smashing, but from a collection of angles and directions, sometimes from both inside and out. After the financial debacle of the movie Cleopatra, 1963, many attached to the studio that made it were fired. David Brown was one of them, but he landed a publishing job in New York with New American Library. The Browns then left California for good. What would the newly notorious Helen do? For the time being, she wrote magazine and newspaper columns. With the help, encouragement, and connections of her husband, he was a former managing editor of the Old Cosmopolitan, for those following the feminist path of Hillary Clinton out of Arkansas, pay heed to the helping hand of marriage. Helen Gurley Brown was eventually given the star vehicle she was looking for, editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan, which was at that time a moribund but commercially-minded literary magazine that the Hearst Corporation felt needed revitalizing. Brown tarted it up. She shortened the articles. Her ethos and aesthetics were mostly her own, but somewhat in step with the sexual revolution, and with a general desire to eschew a female culture devoted to household chores. Brown kept the celebrity interviews, but added a psychotherapy column, plus controversial articles on abortion and the birth control pill. But she did not want anything fancy. She said that her magazine was for girls who have never heard of Mike Nichols. Cosmopolitan flew off the stands. Readers were also perhaps looking for those tips that David Brown cleverly advertised on the cover next to all that Francesco Scavullo photography. Although seemingly a weird new outgrowth of Playboy, Cosmo was also a precursor to a magazine such as O, with its soothing working woman's downtime in a bubble bath quality. Cosmopolitan stood outside any official dogma, except to keep the lonely girl company. And when she became editor-in-chief and made a big success of it, Brown's journey, Hershey would say, unlikely triumph, was complete. The Scarlet Woman, who claimed to have slept with 178 men before she was married, and who had never gone to college, was now settled into something she had always wanted, an enterprise to run. She loved most people. She met Jacqueline Suzanne on the Park Avenue median strip in front of her apartment building, and they became fast friends. She met Gloria Vanderbilt, with whom she became even closer. The Browns were said to move among their peers as plain, simple, and genuine. There was always something small town about them that they exuded. Helen Gurley Brown's penchant for the soft, hard sell was sometimes thought to have come from her years in the advertising business. Not much is made in either Hershey's or Hauser's biography of Brown's southernness. Arkansas is the South, but this is underplayed, though it was very much part of Brown's character and her story. Her self-proclaimed hillbilly roots were mostly just southern. Of course, she was hardly the first steel magnolia to take Manhattan by storm. Truman Capote and his invented Holly-Golightly brought many real-life imitators. But her personal niceness, whispery half-smile, coy flirtations, desire to amuse, locked-in attentiveness, and just-folks quality came largely from a societal expectation of women in the South, perhaps the only expectation she conformed to once transplanted. I recently listened to a friend who, after having sung the praises of charming Southern women, did an impression of a generic Northern woman responding conversationally to a man attempting to engage her. All warmth drained from his face as he pursed his lips and said in ostensible mimicry of the Yankee female, "And what is that supposed to mean?" I laughed my head off because why not? If Hauser's biography sometimes reads like a screen treatment about making a glamorous life, her epigraphs are often movie quotes, particularly from Marilyn Monroe films, and she uses cut to as a transition. Photos, including one of the Browns' grave in the Ozarks, are affixed. Hershey's book, once it gets past its bitter complaint about the Hearst Corporation's virtual gag order on quoting Brown's office memoranda, is a bit more like a novel in its attention to narrative tension and pacing and smooth writing. Moreover, Hershey cleverly transforms her final pages into something akin to an oral history, with several of Brown's good friends, from the playwright Eve Ensler to Barbara Walters, chiming in. Here is Hershey on Joan Rivers speaking of Brown's famous frugality. "Cheap. Don't get Rivers started." She recalled a day when she was in a cab and noticed Helen at a bus stop trying to juggle overstuffed work satchels. Rivers rolled down her window and hollered at her, "Helen, calm down and take a cab. Your husband made Jaws." Brown was politically criticized by better, more conventionally educated feminists, but she was close to women and believed in sorority, if that is a feminist principle. I think her biographers would say, yes, it is. Once the young Kate Millett and her fellow Columbia students took over the Cosmopolitan offices and requested that Brown attend a consciousness-raising session and confess to her hang-ups. This Brown did with alacrity. She had spent all those California years in group therapy and had only gotten to hang-up number 8 when she was asked to sit down and be quiet. There was some froideur with Gloria Steinem and a complete standoff with Joan Didion, but she admired Betty Friedan and raved about the feminine mystique in print. Like Rivers and Efron, Brown believed in having it all, and wrote a book by that title. Having it all is more a fanciful cri de coeur than a feminist idea. Most men don't have it all, but it is true that some women do have more energy, opportunity, and fecundity than others, and if they claim to have some advice in that direction that goes beyond dumb luck and childhood zip code, Let us see how useful it is. Brown, in her 70s, had to be pried from her post at Cosmopolitan. She was given a decorative title as head of the International Division. Hershey reminds us that there are women in hijabs reading the magazine still. The Hearst Corporation also created a facsimile office for the elderly Brown, one that resembled her former one to a T, though the new one was fake. Hershey suggests that perhaps even the fax machine was not plugged in, that perhaps nothing was plugged in. At the end, still in her poochy dresses and fishnet stockings, Brown was wheeled into this office daily and mostly took naps there. Her legacy, imprecisely feminist, is one of putting the pleasure principle dead center in a woman's life, painful cosmetic surgeries notwithstanding, only slightly more complicated than girls just want to have fun. Her biographers defend her from feminist derision and snobbery, and the reader understands this protective inclination, which is rooted largely in affection. Brown was companionable, charitable, self-deprecating. One wants to come to her aid. Hershey and Hauser do not want her to seem an absurd figure, but a unique confection of several eras, cultures, and social strata. She was not an intellectual, but nonetheless, a wee bit of a philosopher. Her critics might line up to say, "Why should men and women have to get tricky with one another? Why all the artifice? Why must snakes be charmed, flesh be doctored? Adults should be treated and behave as adults." Yes, but girlfriend, or rather, pussycat, no matter how evolved, we all contain our basest selves right up until the end. Get out the fishnets and cast them. Seize life. It's really there. Such are the ongoing tidings of Helen Gurley Brown. 2016. Ezra Edelman's O.J., Made in America. Martin Luther King Jr. and others have said that Sunday in America is the most segregated day of the week. But the O.J. Simpson verdict, acquittal on all charges, came in on a Tuesday. The jury, after having been sequestered for the better part of a year, took only 3 hours to deliberate. It knew enough and now wanted to go home. Leaning into the jury box, Simpson's defense attorney, Johnny Cochran, had closed with a rousing speech that the verdict would be not just about Simpson, but a vote for racial justice generally. "Are you, members of the jury, with the brothers or with the man?" as co-prosecutor Christopher Darden described it ahead of time in an objection to the defense strategy. Unknown to a lot of the white world, this idea of voting for something larger than O.J. was felt in many places, not just at the lawyers' tables. When the 1995 verdict was announced, it was a sunny October morning in L.A. Members of the LAPD had come on horseback to the front of the courthouse in case there were riots. People at work and at home were glued to the broadcast. I myself was standing in front of my television set while my baby napped upstairs, snoozing through his last full year of racial blindness, a condition Simpson quixotically believed in and sought for much of his adult life. "I'm not black, I'm O.J.," he repeatedly said, though racial community and fellow feeling would come to his rescue in the end. Even in The Bronco Chase, a minimalist newsreel thriller a la Andy Warhol, those who had thought of Simpson as white joked bleakly that now that he had cop cars following him, he had become black again. A similar line is uttered by a neighbor over the fictional rendition of Christopher Darden's fence in the exposition-jammed dialogue of The People vs. O.J. Simpson, the docudrama that garnered 5 Emmys and disconcertingly serves up the case as entertainment and courtroom soap opera. Young people had cheered on the Bronco from highway overpasses. On the day of the verdict, stock trading dwindled. Water usage dropped. So much work stopped that it was estimated that there was $480 million in lost productivity. Such nationwide attention and suspense suggested that at least some part of the public was alert to this verdict as a species of referendum. Could an African-American man with money get the same breaks that white men with money did. Simpson was a prize to be competed for. Black Americans erupted in jubilation at the news of Simpson's freedom. Crowds hugged in the streets, and the cheering outside the Los Angeles Superior Court startled the LAPD's horses, which reared back and then were trotted away. In the wake of so many acquittals for the killing and maiming of black Angelenos, Eula Love, Latasha Harlins, Rodney King, here was one for the other side. In the courtroom, one of the jurors thrust his fist in the air in black power solidarity. He was an upstanding citizen, but also a former Black Panther, something missed by the prosecution during voir dire. White Americans were by and large vexed and perplexed. Jeffrey Toobin, who covered the case for The New Yorker, exclaimed a little cluelessly about the verdict, "I actually thought I might pass out from shock." 77% of whites believed that Simpson was guilty. 72% of blacks believed him not guilty. Rather than closing the gap, the trial increased these percentages by roughly 10 points from what they had been pre-trial, widening the racial divide in opinion and perception. Whites and blacks had watched the same trial and seen very different things. Their responses to the acquittal took place in separate worlds. "Black people too happy, white people too mad," observed the comedian Chris Rock about the reactions. "I haven't seen white people that mad since they canceled MASH." At the time, I had only one white friend who believed completely in Simpson's innocence. That is, that despite a trail of blood from the crime scene to the Simpson home, he was utterly framed from beginning to end, not just the victim of perjury and illegally enhanced evidence. This friend has also been known to argue that the Apollo moon landing was an elaborately staged hoax, prompted by the Cold War, a belief held by 60% of Russians to this day. In a minor coincidence, O.J. Simpson was in a movie, Capricorn One, also about a fake space landing. In so many parts of his Los Angeles life, reality was ostensible, continually represented as something up for grabs. Most other friends of mine, black and white, shared with me the view that despite the amount of incriminating evidence, the LAPD, primarily in the form of the bigoted police detective Mark Furman, had planted and mishandled some of it and lied on the stand, and that the case in the courtroom was tainted, and so not necessarily proven beyond a reasonable doubt. There was, furthermore, no murder weapon with fingerprints. There was no witness. DNA expert Barry Scheck had poked holes in the forensic science he himself had helped develop. If a man with Simpson's celebrity and money could not stand up successfully against the judicial system with that system's habit of casual fudgings, then no black man could. Simpson was the most famous man to stand trial for murder, let alone the most famous black man. White people couldn't accept that O.J. never broke down, the white father of a black son said to me. White people were waiting for him to fall apart in that courtroom, but he never did. But when I spoke at dinner about it with a well-known white film director who believed completely in Simpson's guilt, and I said offhandedly that I found the logistics puzzling, I could not understand how one person acting alone could have murdered two people like that, so quietly yet brutally with children asleep upstairs, he looked aghast. "Really? You don't?" he said. And then he stood up next to the dinner table and enacted it with a samurai's choreography and an invisible weapon that seemed to be a double-edged sword. Well, what isn't? Watching the director move so assuredly, if somewhat indecipherably, convinced me that he was in the right line of work. But his invisible murder weapon, like the murder weapon that failed ever to make an appearance at the trial, could have used some assistance from a prop department. The FX docudrama, which leans heavily on Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, suggests in passing that Simpson may have learned some knife techniques from a film he was rehearsing about Navy SEALs. The Simpson trial kept people talking for years. It was a touchstone of race, class, and gender tensions. If not the trial of the century, as it was rather dramatically called, it was certainly the trial of the 90s, and lest Americans have forgotten, or weren't born yet, or have had their young imaginations muddled by the docudrama, which is replete with the Kardashian girls, plus John Travolta and Nathan Lane doing camp versions of Robert Shapiro and F. Lee Bailey. Those strong, deep performances are elicited from the actors playing Marcia Clark, Christopher Darden, and Johnny Cochran. A new, sober, and intelligent documentary, produced and directed by Ezra Edelman, the Emmy-winning son of the activist Marion Wright Edelman, has emerged from the unlikely source ESPN to look closely at Simpson's entire life and times, and to see him as the complicated construction that he is. It is titled O.J. Made in America. Many of the books, articles, and films on O.J. Simpson over the years have been aptly titled or subtitled in Dreiserian fashion, An American Tragedy. When one looks at tragedies, one is not looking so much at the protagonist's pure or lusty and always unlucky victims. The story, its meaning and complexity, lies with the perpetrator. Othello, Don Jose, Canio's Pagliaccio in Pagliacci. Only the doomed Carmen gets the title of the opera she is in. And Simpson's story is an opera, a heartbreaking drama that will always be titled O.J., not Nicole and Ron. The tragic hero is one who is in some way exceptional, but, as in the above-named tenor roles, is gripped by a fatal flaw that is often jealousy compounded by dislocation. There may be issues of authenticity or fame-induced imposter syndrome or some other variety of exile. Some fault line in society runs through him as well. His strived for success feels hollow. He is spiritually homeless, humiliated by his lover, and maybe also by his work if the fun part is over, Don Jose, or if he hopes to rest on his laurels, Othello, or if his job is tawdry show business of some sort, Canio, Pagliaccio. Perhaps as part of this story there are themes of race and class, or a narrative of comeuppance. All these elements figure into Simpson's epic fall. After divorcing his high school sweetheart, he married the beautiful 18-year-old waitress whom he'd met in a restaurant, and when she turned out not to be the perfect wife for an aging, womanizing man, she retaliated with infidelities of her own, he began to terrorize and hit her. Edelman's documentary, like the FX docudrama, shows the Rodney King beating right at the start. In the documentary, it is shown at the start of each of the 5 episodes in an opening credit montage of public moments that figure in Simpson's fate and is explored more fully in episode 2. In our current time when some of the most shocking police brutality has emerged for public viewing, one might imagine that the King beating would seem familiar. Yet quite the opposite is true. The footage of it still shocks viscerally to this day. Its pointlessness and sadism resemble a lynching. At that time, there were no body cams or cell phones, and the LAPD had no idea they were being observed. It was at night, and the amount of time given over to the violence is grotesquely leisurely and unperturbed. The black community always knew such things occurred, but when the film evidence emerged, at long last there was proof for the courtroom. Less than 2 weeks later, there was surveillance footage of a grocer shooting black teenager Latasha Harlins in the back of the head. At a time when a conviction for crack possession got black people decades in prison, that the grocer in the Harlins murder served no prison time, and the Los Angeles cops in the King beating were acquitted of state charges, led naturally to community outrage and, unfortunately, to fiery riots that did nothing to bandage wounds anywhere. When an unarmed black man is killed with impunity by police designated to protect and serve, setting the occasional empty car on fire may seem a natural, if desperate, response to years of underlying tensions. But whole black neighborhoods going up in flames in Los Angeles reduced poor Rodney King himself to saying, "Can't we all just get along?" A question whose answer had already been uttered. Daryl Gates, the head of the LAPD at the time, was famous for weaponizing his police force. He defended chokeholds. He introduced SWAT teams and snipers, a move that was imitated in some other urban police departments, often to disastrous effect. As shown in the Utah community of the 2015 Scott Christopherson, Brad Barber documentary, Peace Officer. Edelman's documentary focuses minimally on Gates, but does manage an extended interview with Mark Furman, the police detective who lied during the Simpson trial regarding his personal history of racism and racist epithets, and who eventually lawyered up and pleaded the fifth, even to the question, "Did you plant evidence?" The prosecution's loss was less about the glove found at Simpson's house, which sort of did fit and clearly belonged to Simpson, than about the Fifth Amendment. Also, the forensics team confessed on the stand to taking the blood of the accused from the lab back to the crime scene, admitting it was an unusual thing to do. Though maybe it wasn't. In any case, the prosecution's trail of blood case was no longer a slam dunk. Given the several causes for reasonable doubt, after 267 sequestered days hovered over by guards and given the occasional conjugal visit, the jury felt entitled to take only 3 hours to deliberate. Since they had already been present for the entire trial, they believed they'd had more than enough time for a decision. Nonetheless, the jurors were slandered and reviled for doing so, and continue to be even to this day. Edelman's documentary brilliantly portrays the social backdrop to race in Los Angeles at that time, a police culture of officially sanctioned excessive force leading to several shattering events. The Watts riots, the police killing of Eula Love in front of her home in 1979, and eventually Rodney King in 1991. In L.A. from 1940 to 1960, the African-American population had grown by 600%, many people fleeing Louisiana and Texas, only to face California racism as stark as that of the Jim Crow South. "We didn't ask these people to come here," says Bill Parker, who preceded Gates and was head of the LAPD during the Watts riots. Parker himself was raised in Deadwood, South Dakota, and although he cleaned up the internal corruption on the force, he also turned it into a quasi-military presence, a pernicious occupying army in black neighborhoods. Reputedly, he recruited cops from the KKK. The Simpson family had come to California from a Louisiana farm, and Orenthal James was born and grew up in the San Francisco projects. His father became a drag queen and left the family, dying of AIDS in 1985. The documentary leaves viewers to imagine on their own how a black gay father at that time might have affected a son caught up in the stultifying hyper-masculinity of sports. It surely bound Simpson to his mother, who appears in Edelman's film as a sweet, pretty, religious woman, wheeled mutely in and out of her son's long criminal trial. Though Edelman's film is not about Nicole Brown, she is seen as the great beauty everyone upon meeting her instantly declared her to be. We see her lovely in her wedding dress, basking in the sun with her young child, playing basketball by the pool with her husband's friends who adored her. We see her sexy modeling shots. In fact, beauty is very much a theme in this narrative. Both Simpson and Brown were so good-looking that no actors could convincingly play them. In the docudrama The People vs. O.J., Cuba Gooding is miscast as O.J., and Brown is given no written part at all. She is seen only once as a blurry blonde corpse, foregrounded at her own funeral. In a film industry full of beautiful people, the casting problem is usually the opposite. The actors are too attractive for the people they are playing. A documentary using actual footage of all involved does not have this problem. In Edelman's case, he can also use, and does, home movies and photographs of both victims, so that an honoring trace of their presence persists. But he does not linger there. His story is not about them. If a hero embodies the unspoken virtues and vitality of a society, the tragic hero, Beneath an admirable veneer, flecked with the marks of youthful struggle overcome, also embodies a society's secret illnesses. Simpson suffered from many things having to do with the American success and celebrity and rags-to-riches financial swings, including disconnect from the black community. He also suffered from rickets as a child and severe arthritis as an adult. His beauty when young fed into both insecurity about its loss and sexual entitlement, which fueled jealousy, rage, and narcissism. More contemporary pathological categories might include borderline personality disorder, mental compartmentalization, and concussive head trauma, CTE, from playing football. But speculative medicalizing diminishes the story's power. Edelman's documentary would like implicitly to link Simpson's troubles to the culture of sports, though it also compares him unfavorably to Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Jim Brown, other athletes who were aligned with the civil rights movement and were race men, which Simpson never was nor aspired to be. He was an ambitious party boy from a party school. USC, in 1967, was pretty much beyond the reach of the black community. And after his subsequent professional running back days were over, Simpson was both driven and anxious about money. As his movie career went through its vagaries, he strove to be a successful businessman. He served on corporate boards and did endorsements for rental cars and honey-baked hams, though what he really wanted, a little unrealistically, was to be head of a movie studio. According to the documentary, he was supporting his in-laws. For many years, he was wealthy, famous, and handsome in a land, Los Angeles, that prized such things even more than elsewhere. He loved Hollywood and felt, foolishly, perhaps like Michael Jackson, whom Johnny Cochran also once represented, that he had transcended race. He seemed to feel that lavish materialism would express his accomplishment, that it would signify his success as a black man, that it would speak for itself. He was counter-revolutionary. The documentary handles the trial itself in efficient ways. Interviews with the present-day Mark Furman and the now almost unrecognizable Marcia Clark are perhaps the most interesting. Although, throughout, managing defense attorney Carl Douglas has some of the most memorable remarks. Of Robert Shapiro, he says, "He was not known as a trial dog with two G's." Of Cochran, "Johnny was always that stalwart defender of justice fighting against the Bastille." Of the strong and unusual diversity of the jury, O.J. turned and said, "Guys, if this jury convicts me, maybe I did do it." The verdict was not inexplicable, as much as it might have seemed so to white people watching the trial from their living rooms. The prosecutors, according to Marcia Clark, felt they had lost the case by the time Furman invoked the Fifth. Though Clark closed her case by emphasizing the domestic abuse, hoping to appeal to the women jurors, domestic abuse was not the crime with which Simpson was being charged. Edelman shows Clark cursing out paparazzi in front of her home when she is called back into the courthouse for the verdict. It's clear she knows she has lost. As for the vulnerable and complex Christopher Darden, who initiated O.J.'s trying on of the glove, which prompted Cochran's triumphant rhyme, "If it does not fit, you must acquit," he refused to be included in the film. A loss for Edelman, who also did not have Cochran or Robert Kardashian, both now deceased, nor Judge Lance Ito, who despite inviting Larry King into his chambers, has since rebuffed all publicity. This past spring, however, a somewhat charming and middle-aged Chris Darden did go on The View and on The Today Show, where, among other things, he defended his decision to have Simpson try on the glove and did not deny having been romantically involved with Marcia Clark during the case. Edelman negotiates the legal turns of the trial, most involving blood evidence and its contamination, without getting too bogged down with courtroom psychodrama and the media frenzy that attached to all the participants. The falling out of Shapiro and Cochran at the end is little more than too many bigwigs at the table, but provides an interesting coda. Cochran's playing the race card included playing the Nazi card, and he was not above invoking Hitler when speaking of Furman's racist views. It is an example of Godwin's Law, or Reductio ad Hitlerum, and was an unnecessary move on Cochrane's part. The first person to say Nazi loses the argument, my own students like to say, but Cochrane did not lose, and Shapiro's peeling away and grandstanding after the verdict, holding solo press conferences in which he criticized Cochrane and Bailey, were merely self-serving. But O.J., Made in America, continues well past the trial. It follows Simpson as he tries to salvage his life, despite having become a social pariah in Brentwood. It shows him before he finally leaves for Florida to protect his assets, after losing the civil suit brought by the Goldmans and Browns. Simpson is shown making faked footage, reluctantly packing up, pulling out of the driveway, telling the cameraman to go, waving him away, in order to sell these films to tabloids. The civil suit had assessed the damages at $33 million, and he had no other way to make money. The years in Florida are squalid and surreal. Celia Farber, an Esquire journalist who interviewed Simpson at the time, said she began to feel sorry for him. I kept feeling he was a victim. The level and scope of negative feeling toward him, his banishment from practically everything, she felt had a component of racism in it. But knocked off all his pedestals instead of doing good works, Simpson escaped into strip clubs and unsavory parties. Although the black church reached out to help him and he had read the Bible and the Quran in jail, he did not get religion. He took up golfing with a new social set much lower down the ladder than those he had golfed with in Brentwood. The documentary takes us through the final extraordinary sentencing of Simpson in 2010 for an absurdly small crime, a chapter the public may not have paid much attention to. Because Simpson had lost all his corporate contracts, he was making money through the signing of memorabilia. This is how he paid his lawyers during the trial as well, signing footballs and t-shirts in jail. In the strange mishandling of his personal property after the civil case against him, much personal memorabilia, such as his Heisman Trophy, never intended for sale, went missing. To retrieve some of these possessions, Simpson hatched a plan with some dicey new Florida pals. It was less like a crime and more like a caper out of a movie. They would find the shady memorabilia salesman in a Las Vegas hotel room and confront him. Because two of his friends were carrying guns, it was called armed robbery. Because Simpson said upon entering that nobody was to leave the room, it was called attempted kidnapping. When Simpson pleads with the court that he didn't know he was committing a crime, one is inclined to believe him. But the Nevada judge, clearly not liking the outcome of Simpson's previous criminal trial, and making a kind of end run around the double jeopardy clause in the Constitution, sentenced Simpson to over 33 years, with parole after 7. The number was thought to mirror the $33 million awarded in the civil suit, and the day of the sentencing was the anniversary of the murder charge acquittal. Ron Goldman's father, Fred, was in the Las Vegas courtroom, doggedly looking for justice and solace. Fred Goldman's long, bitter vigil and enthusiasm for the Nevada court's over-the-top conviction could not possibly assuage his sorrow. One cannot judge such grief, though one can compare it, if one dares, to the extravagantly and unsettlingly ready public forgiveness of Dylann Roof by the families of the victims of the Charleston AME church shooting in 2015. Amazing grace indeed, as Barack Obama noted. Edelman's documentary shows O.J., now in prison, looking gray and overweight, while trying to put the best spin on things, his coaching of the prison teams, for instance. When the murder trial is brought up by the parole reviewers, Simpson looks crestfallen. He wants to be rehabilitated in the public mind, and the question serves as a reminder that this will never happen. How did this life go so awry? The documentary veers simultaneously toward and away from the question, probably since at the heart of most individual madness, there is a kind of mystery. Although the sociological threads, sports, race, criminal justice, domestic violence, celebrity, sex, hedonism, are all named and explored, the film is excellent at putting what it can in its cultural context. What the film does especially eye-openingly is look at the much-maligned jury and interview two rather sympathetic members. Further deliberation, something that was expected, might have left the public with a hung jury, a mistrial at best. Even if there hadn't been perjury, mishandled evidence, and general and specific reasonable doubt, if one is a juror and perceives there is a kind of war that involves race, one may feel oneself drafted as a soldier and choose sides. War, which includes battle cries, uniforms, songs, artillery, recruits, and often dishonest obscuring vocabulary, engagement, is the fog itself. The documentary suggests that the jurors felt themselves invited into it, called upon to take care of one of their own, and by the end were battle-weary but not AWOL. In a place where deference to police had been built into the legal system, aggravating racial tensions for decades, this jury would fight back. Did the prison system need one more black man? Did it require this particular black man? The crucial police detective on the crime scene had pleaded the fifth multiple times to questions regarding evidence tampering. The prosecution's case had a large wobble in it. How was a conviction possible? The jurors, for the most part black women from downtown L.A., clearly felt closer to Rodney King than to the white model who had married an admired sports hero. Redemption for one of their own sweetened the technical correctness of the verdict. Nonetheless, with unveiled scorn, co-prosecutor Bill Hodgman looks into Edelman's camera and shockingly calls the jury unfit, a bad lot, a product of reverse social Darwinism. How curious, but inevitable, that our artists and comedians are more fearless in their opinions than, say, our politicians, when it comes to the matter of Black Lives Mattering. In speaking of police culture after this summer's tragic Dallas shootings of three cops, Bill Maher has said, "You cannot shoot unarmed people continually without someone shooting back." When 2 weeks later a black therapist was shot as he lay with his hands raised in a Florida street next to an autistic patient, the still-living therapist asked the cop why he had shot him, and the cop replied, "I don't know." Because he could. Because deep down he believed he was worth more than the black man in the street. Because our country being awash in guns more than any other country in the world, Yemen is second, makes many policemen trigger happy. Because frightened cops make for frightened citizens. Because it feels like a war. People keep saying, "We need to have a conversation about race," Toni Morrison told The Telegraph. "This is the conversation. I want to see a cop shoot a white unarmed teenager in the back." On the subject of O.J., Chris Rock is even edgier. His routine on this topic mentions the $25,000 a month alimony Simpson was paying his estranged wife when he hadn't made a touchdown in 20 years. Violence during divorce is statistically notorious. Almost everyone going through a family breakup is for a time half crazy, and sometimes it shows up on the legal dockets, as Rock himself comprehends. Ron Goldman was Nicole's boyfriend, Rock shouts, and was known to drive around L.A. in the Ferrari that O.J. had bought for her. "I don't even own a Ferrari, but if I saw someone driving my Pinto, that shit would blow up like the Godfather." Rock pauses with his comic's wicked grin. "I'm not saying he should have killed her, but I understand." Prideful rage, as Rock insists, is the story. But the story's outcome rests on a civil right of innocence until guilt is proven in a trial by jury. And with Cochran leading the way, the juror surely had the same facts pressing on them as they came to their conclusions and did their work. The stressful, repeated grinding down of the black man in America, his rights, his image, his identity, his safety, his employment, his finances, his health, his sanity, his dignity, his liberty, his spirit. When we look around at our country and its institutions, as Edelman's documentary asks us to, we can see so much that is sacrificially tainted with this particular human casualty. As a result, in the operatic Simpson tragedy, which includes loving not wisely but also not too well, we can see a hinge to another love story, that of O.J. and his Angeleno jurors, people identified by number rather than name, and whose subsequent condemnation and ostracization mirrored his own. Race trumped gender and class. As Edelman tells it, Simpson's story is intricately entwined with the juries, like the rose and briar vine sprung from doomed lovers in old ballads. The agonist-antagonist-protagonist was saved by a Greek chorus of his peers. Saved somewhat, saved sort of, saved slightly. 2016. Thoughts on Hillary Clinton. December 2016. In 2007 and 2008, I wrote a couple of pieces on Hillary Clinton, which I have not included here. The first one began, "When most of us first saw Hillary Clinton, it was on 60 Minutes, right after the 1992 Super Bowl, and she was seated by her man, saying she was not one of those women who would stand by him." The second piece divided her 2008 supporters into four camps. One, the No Illusions camp. You shouldn't vote with too much hope in your heart. Two, the camp of wounded projection, which includes a lot of women who sacrificed for their husbands too. Three, the we need a woman for president in my lifetime camp, no matter who she is. Four, conflicted macho men seeking redemption. The pieces, which now seem a little OBE, were very much of their time and steeped in the details of the 2008 Democratic primary, during which I was canvassing, in Wisconsin and Indiana, for Barack Obama, who seemed a much more significant and useful figure, historically, sociologically, and temperamentally. Because of her marital leg up, no mischievous innuendo there, don't search, I didn't find Clinton a deeply feminist choice. I didn't see her as representing any systemic change. I did think, on the other hand, that she was smart and quick and had more charisma, why this word, than the press gave her credit for. Both she and Obama could get wonky and dull on the trail when tired, nothing wrong with that. She had a big laugh and real warmth, and sometimes the heat of a beautiful villainess, like the aging queen in Snow White, everyone's favorite character in the Disney film. She was a centrist and a hawk and sometimes dodgy. She publicly recounted dodging fictional sniper fire in a Ronald Reagan-style mind movie set in the former Yugoslavia. She also had a hand in one of the biggest foreign policy catastrophes of our time. This, despite the fearsome Clinton machine, doomed her in a campaign against a younger, less established online community organizer of oddly named peace-loving dwarves, our young people. When she ran inevitably again in 2016, this time as the Democratic nominee, I at long last voted for a Clinton. Had to for the Supreme Court. She was strong on Roe v. Wade. She seemed strong on tightening gun laws. She was adamant about Citizens United. These things, for a change, did not seem to have a waffle in them. One had to put aside Iraq, NAFTA, the demise of Hillary Care, the crime bill, the welfare bill, Waco, Texas, the Goldman Sachs speeches, and other dubious maneuvers with which Clinton and or her husband were associated. One had to hope for the best. Environmental concern was clearly not a priority of anyone's, and this seemed mind-boggling. Clinton was going after Donald Trump's voters when wooing Jill Stein's would have won her some states. We seemed to have two frackers as our major party candidates. Still, I assumed, based on very little apparently, a landslide for her. But then I noticed that she was not stumping much with Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin. There seemed to be no Clinton headquarters in Wisconsin that had an actual phone number. The mayor of Madison subsequently complained in the New York Times that he did not ever get a call from Hillary. In the summertime, elsewhere, she made mention of putting Bill in charge of the economy.